This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. Join me and a crack team of female detectives to reinvestigate more intriguing crimes from the past, all of them committed by women. We're taking a look, a feminist look actually, at murderesses from North America, Australia and Britain. This episode contains material that some listeners may find distressing. Imagine your days as a housemaid in a grand stately home are behind you. You're now enjoying married life with your husband and kids. You've made your home in a small town in the picturesque county of Surrey. It's a pretty, well-to-do part of England. London is handy by train. There are green fields, rolling hills, and there's more than one royal residence nearby. Sounds like rather a lovely place for a woman to raise a happy family. But is it? There are cracks beginning to appear in this pretty picture. How far would you go to stop someone from taking everything you have? Would you take actions that make you so famous or infamous that songs are sung about you?
I beat them all, you may perceive that I was mad, they did believe. I'm a charming duck, I am indeed, says Mrs. Bravovisha.
And I intend to see a solicitor to start legal proceedings and to get full custody of our children.
He left me with no money and was going to take the children away from me.
I was passing the cottage when I saw a pillow covered with blood hanging from the window of one of the rooms.
Some people call me rogue and slut, while others say I am a duck. The bigger the rogue, the better the luck, says Mrs. Bravovisha.
This is Lady Killers, where we re-examine the cases of murderesses from the past. Sounds like a series about death, doesn't it? But secretly, it's about life. It's about women's lives. We hear their voices, we walk in their footsteps, and we ask, how did they do it? Why did they do it? And then we like to ask as well, is life so very different for women today? This is a really distressing case. There's a mother here who raises questions about what good and bad parenting means, but somebody who is undeniably desperate. Back with me on Lady Killers to discuss it is Alexandra Wilson, a barrister specialising in criminal and family law and the author of In Black and White, a young barrister's story of race and class in a broken justice system. Welcome back, Alexandra.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And we also have our resident historian here, Professor Rosalind Crone of the Open University. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Ros.
Now, our story starts in Esher, near to London, in Surrey. Mary Ann Brough is a housewife. Her husband, George, works at the grand 18th century mansion and estate of Claremont nearby. Mary Ann used to work there too. That's how she met George. She gave up her job on marriage, but her connections with Claremont House remain. So Ros and I went to visit it.
We're looking at a green, grassy bowl of a valley, and there were bluebells and little yellow flowers. And ahead of us, there's a fabulous Georgian mansion. It's got a balustrade around the roof. It's made of creamy bricks. And Claremont House became a royal residence in 1816. It was bought then by the British nation as a wedding present for Princess Charlotte. She was getting married to Prince Leopold of Saxe-Coburg. And while they were living here, Charlotte's cousin, the future Queen Victoria, was a frequent visitor. Fast forwarding a bit through time, it's 1841, and Queen Victoria, as she now is looking for a wet nurse. She's pregnant, and she is not into breastfeeding at all. And she remembers Mary Ann as a possibility. She's met her on visits to her uncle Leopold here at Claremont. In November that year, then, Mary Ann gets a job offer. She leaves her husband and children at home and she moves to Buckingham Palace to be the Queen's wet nurse. Roz, what does this slightly strange job of being a wet nurse involve?
A wet nurse was another woman who had a milk supply and was able to breastfeed the child of another mother. Now, wet nurses were common in history for women who were unable to breastfeed for various reasons or who didn't want to. And they remained popular in the 19th century among the upper classes, women who believed they were too refined for breastfeeding, like Queen Victoria. Now, there were problems with this, of course. Wet nurses often came from a lower socioeconomic group, and there was this belief that survived from time past that morals and character could actually be passed through breast milk to the baby.
So this is quite a big opportunity for Mary Ann, though, isn't it? Is it a well-paid job?
She would have been paid £500 for the privilege of being wet nurse, but because the baby was a boy, and hence the Prince of Wales, the heir to the throne, that was increased to £1,000.
So what do the papers say about this? Well, she's a woman from what you might just about call the working classes at this period, right? She's been thrust into public prominence.
She has, and she even plays a key role in the christening of the Prince of Wales.
The christening of the Prince of Wales,
you can see in this newspaper report here from the Liverpool Mercury. So in the carriage between Windsor Castle and the chapel, the nurse of the Prince of Wales, Mrs. Brough, very considerately held the child up to the windows of the carriage.
So that the cheers of the crowd burst forth with a joy almost frantic. So she's right in there with the family.
Yeah, but it doesn't stay that way for long, unfortunately, Lucy. So in September 1842, we learn from the newspapers that the royal nurse has been sacked. So apparently the Queen found her drunk in the royal nursery. And I have here a satirical print from the time, which captures the moment, apparently, when the Queen and her husband, Prince Albert, discover what is going on in the royal nursery.
This is magnificent. Here's the Queen coming in and there's Prince Albert looking utterly horrified. And here we've got the jolly nurse with her bottle of drink. And she seems to be giving a drink to the baby.
Of course, this is symbolic, really. The idea would have been that it would be coming through her breast milk.
And in the caption here, which is supposed to be very funny, she's saying, "Hic, I wonder who you take after. Hic, not your daddy, I'm sure." So she's accusing the Queen of adultery here. "Hic, I'll make you a spirited heir apparent." And by that she means she's filling him with spirits. This is obviously a cartoon. What was the real truth of the situation, do you think?
It's a very difficult job being a wet nurse. She had to bring her baby with her while she was waiting for the birth of the Prince of Wales in order to keep her milk coming. But after that, her baby was sent home and unfortunately died.
That's terrible.
And even though the newspapers carried reports of this very dramatic dismissal, there were other articles that completely dismissed it and said it wasn't true. That in fact, it was a case that her milk hadn't agreed with the baby. Yeah.
So Mary Ann, for whatever reason, gets sent home back to Esher, Claremont area?
That's right.
So, Alexandra, if we think about our society today, I guess some of the issues about wet nursing, which basically means renting another woman's body, come up with something that we hear a lot more about, which is surrogacy, right? Can you talk us through the law about that?
Surrogacy is developing day by day. I think that the reason the law is so quickly changing in this area is because there are so many complications that come with surrogacy. I think the most important one, particularly in this jurisdiction, is whose baby it is at the end of the day. You know, I think those questions are still things that are debated.
Got you. After being sacked from Buckingham Palace, Mary Ann returns to Esher to live with her husband George and their family. By 1854, she has seven surviving children, six of them living with her in Esher.
Their house formerly stood just down the road from Claremont House. So Roz and I went to explore.
Roz and I are now skulking. I think that's a fair description of what we're doing. Behind the garden fence of a row of houses here, and just over the other side of that fence, Roz, you think that's where Marianne Brough's house was, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We're surrounded by very modern houses now, but I've got a copy of an Ordnance Survey map from the 1850s here, and also the census.
Yes.
To try to find where it is. Now, if you look on the map, you can see West End Lodge marked. West End Lodge also still survives today. Now, if we walk through the census, we come to house number 139, and there she is, Marianne Brough, a wife, aged 39.
Well, the children, we've got Mary, who's a dressmaker, Georgina, who's still at school, then is that Caroline?
Caroline,
William, Henry, and Harriet.
And of course, she goes on to have another child before the time of our case.
Were they happy living there, the other side of that fence?
Well, I mean, they did have 10 children, so that suggests quite a fertile relationship. But no, I think there were difficulties. I mean, you might notice on the 1851 census, Mary Ann's living here with the kids, but where's George?
Where is George? Good point.
We find him instead at Claremont House. Here he is, George Brough, 48, and he's a house servant.
Oh, so he has to live on the job.
Right, so he's away from home a lot. Then when we get to the summer of 1854, he suspects his wife is having an affair.
No!
Yes, and he hired a private detective to find out once and for all.
And what did this private detective discover?
Well, the private detective was a man called Henry Field, and George instructed him to follow his wife on the train to London, which Henry did. Now, when he got to London, he watched Marianne meet a man at a tavern, and the two of them went to a house of questionable reputation. Mm. Henry came back to Esher and told George.
After learning about the other man, George confronts Marianne. He leaves the family home and he goes to stay in a pub in Esher. Marianne stays behind with all the kids. George comes back the next day, but only briefly to collect a few things. And he also says this.
I've come to collect my nightcap and nightgown, and I intend to see a solicitor to start legal proceedings and to get full custody of our children.
Well, what kind of legal proceedings do you think he had in mind?
In 1854, ending a marriage and divorce was a very expensive and cumbersome process. So first of all, you had to apply for a legal separation in the ecclesiastical courts. The next step was for the husband to sue the man who had been having an affair with his wife for criminal conversation.
So that's what the private detective was for, to find out who that man was.
Exactly, establish the adultery. And finally, you had to petition for an act of parliament to grant the divorce.
If he was successful, what would happen to their children?
In the early 19th century, children who were born in wedlock were in the sole custody of their father. Now, in 1839, the Infants Custody Act changed that slightly. It allowed a woman to apply in the Court of Equity for custody of children up to the age of 7. However, she could not do so if she was guilty of adultery.
So if he's successful in proving adultery, Marianne's going to lose her children.
Yes, she stands to lose it all.
Alex, how does that compare to the options available to heterosexual couples today?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we really separate the idea of divorce and custody. So first, in relation to divorce, we now have no-fault divorce. You don't need to give any reason as to why you want to get divorced. So adultery is not taken into consideration at all. Then in terms of child custody, the courts look at what's in the best interests of the child. And so unless that adultery had some link to how the child was being treated, that's the only way that I can imagine it would be relevant. And it wouldn't be the adultery per se. It would be whatever impact that had.
It's not well established, but we've got these rumours that maybe Marianne lost her job because she was drunk. Is that something that would be brought up in a custody case today?
Definitely, yes. So something like alcohol or substance misuse is something that's likely to be very relevant to what's in the best interest of a child. And that's because the courts will at least see there being a risk that that would impair a parent's judgment and their ability to properly care for a child.
I'm rather taken with the idea of the private detective following her to the house of questionable reputation. Do people still use private detectives today?
They do. I would say that the age of social media means that often people do a lot of that work themselves. I've had clients who have gone through their partner's phone, social media accounts, emails, letters, you name it, and tried to use that evidence in court to say, for example, my partner cheated on me. We often have to say to the court, this is not relevant to the welfare of the child.
A good judge will care about the kids rather than the hurt feelings of somebody.
Precisely.
So at this time, the custody of any children would automatically go to the husband. But now would you say, Alex, that custody in heterosexual couples tends to go to the woman?
I think that might have been true even up until fairly recently. But in the last few years, we really have been so focused on the best interests of the child, because the dynamic of what was once, you know, considered to be the normal family is changing, and courts have had to adjust to that. It doesn't matter what the family unit looks like. What we're focused on is what's best for the child. So if you looked at the statistics, it may be that there's still more of a leaning towards children living with their mothers rather than their fathers after separation in heterosexual relationships. But I think that would be a reflection of the fact that in society, women are often doing the primary caregiving roles at home.
Do you know what, though? I'm encouraged that you think that is beginning to shift, and the idea that parenting is not necessarily tied to the conventional idea of a woman doing it.
I really, really do think it's starting to shift. I've represented many fathers who have ended up with their children living primarily with them. I think the presumption really even is joint custody. So I think in the vast majority of cases, courts are trying to enable the child to have the best of both, because they recognise that actually both parents are really important in a child's life.
Fascinating. Now, back to the story. It's Friday, the 9th of June, 1854. After this confrontation that Marianne's had with her husband, and with the threat of losing everything hanging over her, Marianne puts the children to bed and she tries to go to sleep herself. The next morning, the 10th of June, workmen walking past the Brough house see something terrible.
About a quarter to 6 o'clock, I was passing the cottage when I saw a pillow covered with blood hanging from the window of one of the rooms. I rang the bell of the cottage. No answer was given. I fancied I saw a shadow of some person moving in the house. I got a ladder and ascended it and looked into the room. I then saw her standing at the top of the staircase, and I saw that her throat was cut and her hands and face were covered with blood, and her hair hung about her face. She was making a whistling noise, apparently from the wound. I went for a doctor.
And another passerby actually went into the house.
I saw the prisoner lying on the bed, and I saw one child lying on the window with his throat cut. In another room, I saw two other children lying with their throats also cut. In another room, found three children, all with their throats cut and quite dead.
That's an awful, awful sight. Six murdered children, and Marianne, having tried to cut her own throat, she's covered in blood and unable to talk. A doctor arrives to treat Marianne, and the next day she wants to give a statement.
On Friday last, I was bad all day. In the evening, I put the children to bed, and I came up to bed. There was something like a cloud, and I thought I would go down and get a knife and cut my own throat. I groped about in Master's room for a razor. I went to Georgie and cut her first. I did not look at her. I then came to Carrie and cut her, then to Henry. He said, "Don't, Mother." I said I must, and did cut him. Then I went to Bill. I served him the same. The two children here, Harriet and George, were awake. They made no resistance at all. I then laid down and hid myself. I cannot tell what occurred for some time after that, as I found myself weak and lying on the floor. That nasty great and black cloud was gone then. I went to the window and put something out to call attention. I went to bed and remained here until the bell rang.
Alexandra, what do you make of that statement?
My honest gut reaction was that it's devastating. I think if I was the lawyer in that case, you know, transporting myself back in time, the first thing that I'd be thinking is this person needs to have a psychiatric assessment. Let's see if there's any underlying mental health issues or difficulties.
But Mary-Anne actually tells a different story to the woman who's been nursing her.
He left me with no money and was going to take the children away from me. I was not going to allow him to do so.
So we got two different statements with two different reasons for what Mary-Anne had done. One seems to mention this black cloud, and then the other is the threat of losing her children. What's going on? Can both of these things be correct?
They might both be correct. Inconsistent statements is something that we deal with a lot as lawyers. In fact, if I was prosecuting this case, I would absolutely love the fact that she said such different things. But I think you could say that actually these aren't as inconsistent as they seem, that there may have been some underlying concern that she was going to lose her children and that that had some bearing on her mental health. Those two things don't have to be seen as completely distinct, different things.
Are there any modern day cases this reminds you of where we've got parents killing children or acting in really extreme ways rather than letting the other partner take full custody away from them?
I certainly know that there are cases where parents kill their children, and often there is some dispute between the parents, and that's reflected in the children being harmed. I remember the first time that I met a client that had killed their own child, I was quite nervous about it. I had these preconceived ideas that I think a lot of us have in society that we're just like, oh, this person must be just evil. But one thing I realized is that I strongly feel that everyone, no matter whether they are perceived as guilty, whether they actually are guilty, everyone deserves proper legal representation. Even looking at this case, it's so easy to say, you know, this is a mother who killed her six children.
Must be a monster.
Must be a monster, must be evil. Who could do that? And I think that's most people's gut reaction. But then even as we've seen, when you start to look through the circumstances, there may be other factors at play.
Well, let's find out what happens next. When she's recovered a bit from her self-inflicted wound, Mary-Anne is arrested and indicted for the murders of her children. On the 9th of August, 1854, she goes on trial in Guildford and pleads not guilty due to insanity. Ross, let's turn to you on this. Why would Mary-Anne claim insanity in her defence?
Well, the simple answer to that, Lucy, is either because it's true or because she's trying to avoid the gallows, which would have been the punishment for this crime. Now, I've brought with me a very detailed account of the trial that was published in The Times. It describes witnesses testifying to the good character of Mary-Anne, how she was a loving mother and so on. It also describes her doctor giving evidence of her medical history. And he says that before the birth of her last child, she suffered from severe nosebleeds and a terrible pain in her head. And after the birth of that child, she had a paralytic attack, resulting in some loss of physical function, and her speech was slurred too. And finally, the defence brings forward a very famous psychiatrist, Dr. Forbes Winslow, as an expert witness. He claims that he has seen this happen quite a bit, where a good mother has a temporary moment of insanity that is triggered by something. Now, it's interesting that he doesn't relate the trigger of this attack to her husband's desire to take custody of the children. Instead, he talks about how the children have been ill and up at night, so she's been tending to them, and that would have put pressure on her. Now, at this time, understandings of mental health were very heavily gendered. Society saw mothers only in a nurturing and caring role. So with such a horrendous crime, there was a real desire to explain it. And the idea of temporary insanity helped people to do that.
Well, do you want to know what happened, Alex?
Oh, I certainly do.
Mary-Anne is found not guilty by reason of insanity, and she gets sent to Bethlehem Asylum. So, Roz, do you think, from what you know, that Mary-Anne really had some form of illness?
Yes. Now, I've brought with me some of the asylum records that give us information about Mary-Anne's time at Bethlehem, which should help us answer that question. The first one I have here is the admissions register that tells us that Marianne was in good health when she arrived. And here I have the incurable and criminals register, and this tells us that Marianne died a few years later on the 18th of March, 1861, from paralysis and apoplexy. At the inquest into her death in 1861, the asylum doctor who treated her talked about her declining health. She had paralytic attacks, frequent ones in the lead up to her death, and he said that he was convinced of her insanity.
So Marianne was having these ongoing medical problems, but the timing of the tragedy does seem to be linked to her husband threatening to leave her penniless and take her children away. Alex, you've told us that today it's no longer the case that custody goes automatically to either the mother or the father. Does that mean that you think that the law is now gender blind?
It would be artificial to claim it's completely gender blind because so much of our notion of what is good for a child is based in gender stereotypes. And I think that we still prioritise a lot of feminine characteristics as things that we might consider maternal as good for a child. And that can sometimes disadvantage a father in proceedings. And so I think without completely removing all of that bias, which may not even be possible, the courts are not going to be truly gender blind. But I do think they're a lot better.
This is such a sad story. Marianne does seem to have been really ill. It's interesting to wonder what would have happened to her today. Would she have got better treatment? Hope so. And I also hope she would have been less scared of her husband taking her children away. I think this case is so upsetting because it seems so unlikely, so unnatural that a woman would kill her own children. But do you know what? I think that presumption in itself is sexist. It tells you that our ideas about parenting roles, whatever the law may think, are still very firmly rooted in gender.
Well, here I am, as you may view, though I a dreadful deed did do. I beat the judge and jury too. I am Mrs. Bravisha.
Well, a huge thank you to our guest detective for this episode, Alexandra Wilson, and to Professor Rosalind Crone at the Open University. Next time, we'll be joined by Helen Lewis, author of Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights, to discuss our very own difficult women here at Lady Killers. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Hannah Fisher, and the readers are Jonathan Keeble and Claire Corbett, and the singer is Olivia Bloor. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. If you want to know even more about how we bring these fascinating stories to life for this podcast, you can join Roz and I for an exclusive behind-the-scenes chat about what it takes to make Lady Killers. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.
Hello, my name's Greg Jenner. I am the host of You're Dead to Me, the Radio 4 comedy show that takes history seriously and then laughs at it. And I just wanted to say that if you like laughing, if you like learning, if you like history, or if you hated history at school, well, we are the show for you. Yes, every episode I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. We do stuff you did at school, and we do stuff you've never even heard of. So if that sounds like fun, you can check out our back catalogue and our new series on BBC Sounds. Just type in You're Dead to Me and hit subscribe. Thank you. Bye.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation, spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. but what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.